Greetings, and welcome to the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Jennifer Shmerka. Thank you, Ms. Shmerka. You may begin.
Thank you, Doug. Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the IOMSN and as co-chair for this program, I'd like to welcome you to the second installment of the monthly Town Hall Discussions. This evening's discussion is entitled, When the Patient is Experiencing Breakthrough Disease. As a reminder, these educational sessions will be held by telephone on the third Tuesday of each month. Each Town Hall discussion will be led by an IOMSN member. They will speak on a topic for approximately 15 minutes, and then we will follow with an open discussion, with the entirety being limited to 1 hour. We would like to also acknowledge and show our appreciation to Biogen IDECT this evening for supporting this project through an unrestricted educational grant. It is now my pleasure to introduce you to our speaker this evening. Tonight's guest is Dr. Aliza Ben-Zachariah. Aliza is a board-certified nurse practitioner and practices at the Corinne Goldensmith Dickinson Center for Multiple Sclerosis at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York City. She earned her Bachelor's of Science in Nursing from Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Israel, and her master's from Hunter College, which is the Bellevue School of Nursing, with a nurse practitioner certificate from Columbia University. And then in 2010, Aliza completed her doctorate degree in nursing practice from Case Western Reserve University, focusing on education. Dr. Ben-Zachariah was among the first group of nurses to be certified in MS nursing. She's published numerous chapters and articles about different topics, including MS genetics, MS overview, disease-modifying therapies, symptom management, and palliative care in MS. And she also serves as chair of the IOMSN Nurses website and committee. And it's truly my honor to introduce my friend and my colleague, Dr. Aliza Ben-Zachariah, to you this evening. And so please join me in welcoming her for this evening's meeting. Aliza, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Thank you so much, Jen. Yeah, my name is a mouthful sometimes. Anyhow, good evening, everyone. So my topic again is when a patient experiences breakthrough disease. I will try to cover a little information about the definition of breakthrough disease or suboptimal response. And even though there is consensus, there is debate, there is none, and then talking about the tools that help us identify when a patient has suboptimal response, and then going into treatment. So I have 15 minutes. So let me start. Maybe I should speak quickly, and then I'll cover everything very quickly. So what do we mean when we talk about breakthrough disease? And why it's important to define it, really? And let me begin why it's important to define. We know that patients respond to the disease-modifying therapy differently. It's highly variable. We know that some of the disease-modifying agent in MS become ineffective as the disease progresses and become either secondary progressive or either they have a different route completely, or that one DMT might work while others may not. And we know that MS has a very heterogeneous disease. It has a great variability in clinical presentation, underlying pathology, and also MRI presentations. So we know it's important to identify when it is, and you don't want to miss the wheel or miss the boat, whatever the idiom is, because you know that there is no treatment that reverse any clinical deficit, neurological. Once you lose neurological function, it's hard to get it back. So you want to identify suboptimal response as soon as possible and address it. So definition, so what is the definition? And I'll be interested to hear your definition. So I think there is an umbrella that most of us as clinicians agree upon. We know that when we say suboptimal response, we know that patient has positive clinical or and positive radiological activity or progression of disease despite the DMA. It does not, though, imply that a patient has not responded to therapy completely, but it does imply that there is disease activity even though they are on disease medications. And you have to really think about this. I think as nurses and all other clinicians, I think we always think about adherence, and I will say short sentence about it, because sometimes people can have a pseudo, some of the literature and the articles I read talk about, which I thought it was interesting, they talk about pseudo breakthrough disease, because what happened when patients are not taking the medication? And I think that's the first question that has to come when we think about suboptimal response. Because they have to take the medication if we want to really define them as suboptimal response. I think many also clinicians on a different point do not want to call it treatment failure because it can imply to patients that they have failed, that this is really not the case. The other things that I think clinicians refrain from using, the word non-responders, because that implied that really we know how and we have strategies to quantify the degree a patient responds to disease-modifying agents, and we really don't. There are lots of scientists, researchers looking at markers, how to quantify response to copaxone, glatiramer acetate, or response to interferon. The only marker of breakthrough that we have is when patients have neutralizing antibodies, and we know that probably their medication are not completely effective. That's it about neutralizing antibodies. So, and again, this is the umbrella. I think the American clinician, and I'm specifying American as versus Canadian, for example, because Canadian came with some kind of a table that I'll speak in a minute. But I think us in the U.S., I think we agree about the clinical and radiological activity, but I think there is no consensus as far as the numbers. So how many clinical attacks a year really can tell you breakthrough disease? Is it one? Is it two? Is it three? Are we looking at severity? Is it one major attack versus two very mild attack or three mild attack? Are you looking at changes on the neurological exam, clinical deficits based on the expanded disability status scale? So you look at that. And I think the numbers are a debate, and I think each of the clinicians based a lot of their opinion about their clinical and personal experience, including evidence-based trials. So as you see, I think there's sometimes some disagreement about the numbers of relapses or the number of lesions, for example, on MRI, 10 lesions on or 10 enhancing lesion, active lesion, or burden of diseases measured by T2 lesions. And I think this is when there is some debate. The issue is pretty large in extent because there are some studies that show that at least one-third of patients may show suboptimal response during the first years of treatment. If you looked at Tremlett, at COIL articles, so there are some numbers, and if you'll be interested, we can always send you some citation for articles. So there are some again, some study that showed that about 50% of patients will have a relapse with at least one relapse in the first 2 years, or more than 30% will have changes on the EDSS in the initial years. So we know other studies show that about 70% of patients experience relapses in the first years, and that's in Johnson trial and others. So important to remember, people do change over time. How much change? Is it mainly in the first year? And really, again, it's important to identify the changes. The tools, which I briefly, actually before I go to the tools, so Canadian team in 2004, led by Dr. Mark Friedman, came up with a table, which I think is very interesting. They came up how to determine patient responsible to treatment and their outcome that they consider They look at clinical relapses. They look at frequency and severity and extent of recovery as well from relapses. Then they look at the second parameter was disease progression based on the expanded disability status scale progression. And the third parameter was the MRI activity, increased disease burden or activity. And what they when they look at relapse assessment, they divide it into concern level, low, medium, and high. And they did it for the EDSS and the MRI. So, for example, when they look at the relapse assessment, they look at rate, and low concern was moderate reduction versus the baseline. So, really, low concern, it's a major reduction in relapse rate once you initiate treatment, disease-modifying agents. And when they did that, they talked mainly about the first-line treatment. We're talking about interferon or glatiramer acetate. So, and then modest, medium concern, when someone has a modest reduction, about 35 to 75% reduction in relapse rate, and that's just number talking, versus the baseline, whatever they've been before initiation of treatment. And high concern, when someone has a really minimal reduction in the number of rate as compared to baseline, less than 35. Then they look at severity. Low concern, someone that have a mild relapse. Medium concern, when someone had a moderate relapse. And severe concern was a high, high concern was someone that has a severe relapse. And that was a relapse that require, for example, IV steroids, and they develop major deficits. And they mentioned some example about severe motor relapse, for example, a cerebellar relapse. And then the third one was the recovery, how they recover from relapse. And I think this is really it's a nice table. My question is always has been, and I have not spoken about this with a clinician in Canada, do they apply it clinically? Do they use it? And they have done the same thing, as I mentioned to you right now, about relapse assessment, about disability progression assessment. The main point, I won't go over each one, the low, medium, high, and it's published information in the Canadian Journal of Neurological Science. I think it's interesting that, for example, when they look at the low EDSS, they have a higher threshold for change. So they say changes in 2 point and less than 2 point. And as you go higher EDSS, you don't want to change much there because your threshold is much higher because everything else they lose and they become on a higher and higher EDSS, definitely they lose more and more neurological function. And then they look at the MRI, which they look at new activities and new T2 lesion, and they look also at black hole, T1 hypointense lesion showing axonal loss. And they mentioned low concern any new lesion, and medium concern was any increase in two MRI categories. So let's say if you have more lesion on T2 and gadolinium, and active lesions. Oh, so it's in two different views of the MRI. And then they sum it up, which I think it's interesting. So they put it all together. If you have an MS patient, it would be a suboptimal response to medication if all three outcomes show low level of concern. So they have low level of concern from relapse, low level from EDSS, and low level from MRI. So you take all that. Or they have any two outcomes that show medium level, or you have a single outcome that show high level. So let's say they had a high level of concern related to relapse. So even in one area, and they have those three areas, I think it's very interesting method, and it will be interesting to see if clinically that was at any point was used in Canada. So I already mentioned the tool that we really use to measure suboptimal response are our clinical exam, but it's more the EDSS, expanded disability status scale. So any changes on that scale. Some will use also the multiple sclerosis functional composite because it has some cognitive component too. And that's important as well to show progression of illness. We cannot really look and limit ourselves only to physical finding. You have to include the cognitive finding in cell. As well, because as we know as clinicians and nurses that MS not only affect your physical status but also your cognitive status. So, and then when you look at MRI, that we have heavily used this tool for the last few decades since the 1980s. Important tool. However, you want to see most of the time you want to see combination of clinical and radiological activity, not only the radiological. I hope you're aware and familiar with the EDSS and the MSSC. You always can find it on different websites and also through the IOMSN information. Another measure that probably you can assess progression of illness could be optical coherence tomography, which really measure the axonal loss in the retina and give us some idea about axonal loss around the optic nerves. Important because it does have some prognostic value. So it does tell you when the disease, especially if you have a baseline test, and then you can monitor it over time. Very interesting. We talked briefly about MRI, again, as I mentioned. All of you and many patients, I think all the patients in the U.S. definitely have baseline brain MRI, and most of them also have cervical spine MRI, so you can monitor. There's some new data about test, spinal fluids, and some other biological, but nothing has been determined as yet. So once you, let's say, define breakthrough disease, a suboptimal response, you have the tools to evaluate and you monitor carefully patient, then you want to go to the next level. What do we do next as clinicians? We have to do something. So if someone has a breakthrough disease, maybe you change the treatment. You might go, let's say, from first line to another first line treatment. You might go from one first line, and when I say first line, I mean interferon or glatiramer, and then you go to a second line treatment, maybe natalizumab, maybe chemotherapy drugs, maybe Gilenya, the new fingolimod, the new oral medications, which definitely has some more safety concern. Or maybe you do add-on therapy. You put interferon and glatiramer together. Or you do interferon and other combination, pulse steroids, other medications that you will consider in your practice. And if you have other idea, definitely be very happy to hear. And you have to think about when you treat patients, you have to think about either immunosuppression or immunomodulation and what really fits as each patient. And think about their lifestyle and either injections or other mode of treatment. So, again, important when you think about the changes, discuss this with patients openly. They're a partner in the treatment, and they need to know that they're not responded adequately to the medication they're on, in assuming that they are taking their medications, and hopefully they are truthful enough to let us know if they are not taking their medications. But I think it's really a partnership, and we need to work with them. You can treat the symptoms, you can do rehabilitation, you can do treat psychosocial issue, do some cognitive remediation, but it's important to, with all that, to maintain some quality of life, you want to make sure that you treat aggressively the disease, especially if someone has a suboptimal response. So, and I think that's why it's so important to really identify it very quickly and then go from there to the next level. In MS, it's a lot of trial of error, correct? I mean, there's nothing I can check and say, oh, Mr. Smith, this medication is for you. You will be okay with this. And we can't do that. You have to try, and we sometimes miss some times. But that's why you need to almost be on the alert. You evaluate patients every 6 weeks, every 3 months, every month. You have to really do it individually based on the progression and the changes the patient presents. And again, not allow us to miss things as we evaluate patients. I think we're not perfect, and we don't have a lot of specific tools to evaluate the effectiveness of this medication. But I think we have some tools today that can help us identify when a patient doesn't respond as we'd like them to, and measure this tool and follow up neutralizing antibody and use all the tools available and then advise regarding any other treatments.
Yeah, I agree, Lisa. I think I want to thank you. That's really a very robust discussion, and certainly a lot to fit into 15 minutes, but I wanted to go ahead and allow time for us to open up the lines for questions. And Lisa, I wanted to give you an opportunity. I know you had worked on several questions that you wanted to pose to the audience. And so I wanted to at least give you an opportunity to ask the first question, if you will. And Doug, if we could, we could just open up the queue and allow, after Lisa poses the first question, allow people to call in and answer and generate the discussion.
I would really wonder. I mean, I think one of the main questions that I always have, I really would love to have some input from you to see how do you define, or the team that's working with you, how do you define suboptimal response? What is your threshold to evaluate patients and do you look at clinical? Do you look at radiological? Do you have some kind of a definition, or you just go as you go and you see patient and say, this is it? Or just based on your working relation, the team approach in your center, I'd be curious to know, what is your definition of breakthrough disease, a suboptimal response?
Great. Can we open up the lines, Doug?
Thank you. We will now be conducting a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key. One moment while we poll for questions. Our first question comes from the line of June Halper from Fairlawn, New Jersey. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Jen. Really great talk, Lisa. Very, very good talk, and very comprehensive in 15 minutes. You did it.
Thank you.
It's very difficult, you know, to define suboptimal response, and based on the parameters that you brought up, that's all clinical, you know, and radiological. But then you have the patient that says, I'm getting worse, and that's how I start worrying more than, you know, running for the MRI, although we do follow up. You know, patient seems to be the best reporter, and I think that's one of the things that we are very, very much in need of. In fact, the IOMSN is trying to pilot and develop a tool where the patient can start monitoring their own MS. And because we're starting to find that people really are quite sensitive, of course, the first thing we do is to evaluate for other things going on, such an infection. But you're right. I mean, from the scientific perspective, we got to use all those tools that you have. But I think we most importantly have to listen to the patient, because at times it's not relapses and it's not new enhancing lesions. It's just they are getting worse and they're just not doing well.
Hi, June, it's Jen. I just wanted to jump in real quick and then give the floor to Aliza, but I completely agree with you. And I want to say, I think maybe that goes back to our, you know, our diagnostic criteria. It still remains a clinical diagnosis based on two events disseminated in time and space with the surrogate data as supportive data. And I think you are absolutely right in what I feel is too, is that you go to the patient first, and it's really up to them to give you that history, that there has been some breakthrough in their experience with the disease-modifying therapies, and then go to all the other scientific measures by which to fortify kind of what they're telling you.
Great point, June. I think sometimes you go to the relapses and you go to the radiological, and I think the tools we have, and you mentioned it, and then you, because you always try to look at something to show us objective changes, but it's such a great point, because lately I've seen some patients that they tell you that they're worse, and you're right, you have to really talk to the patients and evaluate them, but sometimes they are worse and you don't see those measures and you don't see an objective, and I think as clinicians sometimes we want to see that, and I think maybe we require some education. Even physicians I work with, I think we don't really, we believe patients, but I think we believe more if we see some measure that we can quantify and see the changes on MRI. But it's hard for us, I think, when a patient tells us that they are worse, and we see it sometimes that they are worse, but we can't really, we don't see such major changes on the clinical exam, and we don't see any change on MRI. It's all calm, it's the same, no interval changes. And it's, I think sometimes it's hard for us to look at that, but I think we should, and I think we should maybe look at things differently and maybe even look at different parameters for criteria. But it's funny that lately both Dr. Loveland and I saw some patients that are really feel worse, and their ability to function on a daily basis is different. And when they come and we don't measure anything, it's just hard for us. But I completely agree with you. I'm not sure what to do with that at this point. But we do change sometimes therapy, and we do different things for patients that tell us they're worse, maybe not on the first visit, but definitely on the second, on the third. So I think you need to combine the patient feelings of most patients that give you accurate information. And I think after a while, you know your patients, you know, patients.
Absolutely.
That give
you know your patients, the ones that are really frightened and
yes.
just over-exaggerating perhaps.
Yes.
But I think, you know, I'm going to get off in 2 seconds, but I think two things that I would have found to be very subtle, important measures is the 25-foot timed walk for the ambulatory patient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the other things is the cognitive. And
yes.
I think it would be wonderful to have a bedside or a chairside tool, because subtle changes in cognition scare me out of my wits, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's scary. But anyway, I better get off because I'm monopolizing. Thanks a lot, Elisa.
Thanks,
congratulations.
Thank you
Bye.
So much. Thank you. Any other questions? Any other comments?
I think we have a couple of questions in queue.
Okay.
Doug, can we go ahead and open those?
Yes. Our next comes from the line of Pat Kennedy from Denver, Colorado. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you, and thanks, Elisa. What a great talk. I really appreciated what you had to say. And building on what you said and what June said, I think we also have to think about our patients who come into us and they think that they're not doing well. And, you know, we go through all the things that you talked about, and we know our patients, and we try to get a little deeper. And sometimes what happens is that their expectations of what they might be expecting from their medication are sometimes higher than what is reality. And I do think that as nurses and as nurse educators, we need to spend that time to sort of get to the bottom of this. You know, what were you expecting? And, you know, this is what you've experienced now. Let's look at this in the bigger picture. And, you know, sometimes, in fact, they are getting worse. There's no question. But other times, it's that their expectations were that they were going to be symptom-free. They would never have a flare-up. They would never have whatever. And I think we have to be real careful to listen really carefully, because if it is an expectation matter, sometimes with good education, we can explain sort of the reality of the situation. We can talk about other options. They still may choose those other options, and we may decide to go with that, because if their belief system says, that's what I need, then that's probably the best treatment. But I do think we need to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, well, now let's talk about those expectations. So thanks.
Thank you so much for your comment. Yeah, no question about it. You know, and sometimes that education has to repeat it again and again, because patient hears sometimes what they want to hear, and you remember speaking with them about what's the expectation of the treatment, what does it mean to initiate treatment with glatiramer or interferon. It's not full control of the disease, and you explain to them, but you're absolutely right. I think it's education and re-education over and over again. Absolutely, no question.
Great. That's great input. Thank you, Pat, for calling in. Is there another question, Doug?
Our next question comes from the line of Tony Saldana King from Houston, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Elisa. Great talk. I don't know if you guys can hear me, or am I still on mute?
No, we can hear you.
Okay, good. just a quick question. Some of the patients, what if they've kind of tried, like, all, you know, the ABCR and the T, and the ABCR and the T, I mean, sorry, not the T, but have done the site, maybe some of the chemotherapy medications or the immunosuppressions? And then what are your thoughts I mean, you know, Tysabri was definitely a good option, but with the having the chemotherapy, that kind of increases your chances with the PML. And I was just wondering, you know, would either Tysabri or Gilenya kind of be the better choice for those folks? Because it's kind of nice that they have options, but what if they run out?
So that's thanks so much.
That's tricky, sorry.
Yeah, very tricky, complex question. So I think today you really have to think before you go on to a second line treatment, you need to think about the future. And you need to think about what you do next. And you're right. So what do you do once a patient did the first line, went to chemo, and you are really concerned about future? I think if patient, for example, has history of infection or even UTIs and some issue with anything, either viral or bacterial infection, and already has been on chemo, sometimes we go back to the first-line treatment and okay. hope that maybe the chemotherapy has suppressed the illness and work almost like an induction therapy, and then you go on back to the first line. Is it an ideal? We don't know.
Right.
Is it safe to go to Tysabri at this point and atezolizumab, or even go to Gilenya? We don't know. These are called immunomodifiers, but they have immunosuppressive consequences. I think we don't really know the answer to that, and it's a tough issue to deal with clinically, and it will get worse in the future. And that's why I think from the first time you treat patients, you really need to think about the future. But the natalizumab is available just in the last few years. And if that patient was on chemo before we have this new agent, that's a different thought. But I think today when you look at patient, you have to think, so you don't want to exhaust and go to the most aggressive drug maybe initially because you don't have room where to go from there if they are not doing well on that medication, or you go back to the first line. But that's a debate. You know, do you want to be aggressive and then use maybe natalizumab as an induction and then go to first line? But I think, again, if you think about being safe and being conservative, I probably would go to first line and just monitor the patient, either high-dose interferon or glatiramer. And if they were on one of them before and didn't work, I might go on the others. Because I'm not sure about the safety of fingolimod or natalizumab once you have been on chemotherapeutic agent before.
Thank you, Tony, for your question. We ready to move on to the next question?
Our next question comes from the line of Stephanie Agrella from Round Rock, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Aliza. Hi, Jen. I just wanted to see what you all are telling your patients, the ones that have been doing very well on their injectable for many, many years, and now that there is an oral medication available, are pounding on the doors and requesting that we call in prescriptions to their nearest pharmacy for this medication. I know what we're doing. I just wanted to check with you all to hear what you all, you know, what kind of education and information you're passing on to patients as well.
So we educated patients even before the drug came out because we knew it would be questioned. And anyhow, I always discuss with patients any research, current research protocol or new medication coming into market in a few months. And I always told my patients that they're doing well, they're staying on the current medication. Did I say it like this? I said it's important not to fix something that's not broken. And if you educate patient and you tell them you're doing well, these medications were tested for more years than the new medication. They're fairly safe. And you're doing well on the current drug. There's no reason to change. We have not changed too many. People are actually not too pushy in New York State. I don't know about your state, but I think they're well-educated. They think about the safety, and these are all young people, business people. They heard about the oral drug. They got numerous articles, numerous calls from their friends. They come in, they ask, they talk, and they continue their disease-modifying agents, the injectable. And most patients understanding, most people say, you know, it's a new drug, I'll stay on my medication, I'll do well, and I'll go from there. So it has been really interesting, but I could tell you very honestly, there was not jump in my practice, there was for my patient, there was not jump to the oral drug. I will be interested if a lot of people in your state wanted the oral pill. You didn't mention it. You just
Well, Aliza, you know, we did very much like you all did. We educated them before it even came out or even, you know, got approved. And so, and again, you know, these patients are very well educated. They get online, they talk in their support groups, and so many of them already knew that it was not something that they were going to be interested in immediately. And so for most of them, it wasn't really much of a discussion. We already knew that, you know, they were doing well on what they were on, and they weren't comfortable with switching to something with an unknown risk profile. And so for the majority of our patients, it's not been an issue.
Great.
Thank
you so much.
Great input. And actually, I'd like to there's another question in queue, so I'd like to answer that. But I'd also like to put out to the rest of the listeners, if anyone else wants to call in with a response to Stephanie's question, as she did pose the question to everybody. So but go ahead and take the next question or comment.
Our next question or comment comes from the line of Carolyn Griffin from Worcester, Massachusetts. Please proceed with your question or comment.
Hi, Doctor. Thank you very much for that talk. And I wanted to actually respond to Stephanie's question that even though, again, we were actually a site for the fingolimod study, the practitioners in our practice as well is following Dr. Ben Zachariah's practice in saying that if they're doing well, do not change the treatment, and they'd like to actually get some more data before they felt comfortable offering that to our patients right now. So I haven't seen that happen in the practice. And quite frankly, the patients, you know, are accepting that. I think that, you know, that speaks well that they, you know, have good trust in their practitioners. But again, it's not been a big jump or a big change at all to go to the oral drug.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's uplifting.
Thanks, Carolyn from Worcester, Massachusetts. And we'll take the next caller if there's one.
Our next question or comment is a follow-up question from the line of Tony Saldana King from Houston, Texas. Please proceed with your question or comment.
Hi, Lee. Sorry, I just want to say I got disconnected, but thank you for answering the majority of the question. And it was just a response to Stephanie and also to you guys. I think everybody, like you said, all of our patients are pretty knowledgeable. And I think when Tysabri first got taken off the market, I think that made everybody very cautious, especially our patients. And so not everybody was kind of jumping on the bandwagon to get out. So that was just my comment. And thanks again for the complex answer.
You're welcome. Thanks so much, Tony.
Thanks, Tony. Anyone in queue?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Lori Mayer. Please proceed with your question or comment.
Hi, Jen. Hi, Aliza. Good discussion tonight. I do have a little bit of a different question for you. With the relapse rates and the reduction of the relapse rates that we're seeing in some of the placebo-controlled trials, say with Tysabri and fingolimod, and patients are very much aware of that, but do you think with some of these newer drugs on the market that we're going to see a shift in the paradigm as for what our definition of breakthrough disease is going to be? Do you think there'll be some changes?
I think, well, number one, I think these trials are tested now, and I think a lot of our specialists commented on the differences. And we have to remember that this new agent were not compared head-to-head to high-dose interferon. They were not compared head-to-head to glatiramer acetate. They were compared to the low-dose interferon, some of them, so head-to-head. So it's interesting you have a reduction in relapse rate. Is it better? People believe that the newer agents are stronger. We can't really say or answer the question or say they're better than Glatiramer, they're better than higher dose because they were not compared head-to-head. But again, most clinicians will believe, and I had many talks about natalizumab, and I had many talks about fingolimod, that they are stronger. Would it change our paradigm? I'm not sure. The relapse reduction rate, looking at the criteria of treatments, I'm not sure it will change, because we're talking about the reduction in the rate. Are we talking about this? We don't talk about severity of relapses, really. We talk just about the numbers here, because that's what they can capture in clinical trials. So I'm not sure the definition will change and we get different criteria. I'm not sure about that, but I know that, like, for example, there are new criteria for radiological criteria that's going to be in press soon. I think they're already accepted by the Annals of Neurology, and Fred Lublin was one of the people on the committee. So they actually even making more of an earlier diagnosis of MS. So the definition of clinical definite MS will change based on MRI, and there is new criteria that will make it really early. You'll see one lesion, it's already becoming MS. So I think early treatment has been changing and people becoming more aggressive in treating early. But I don't know if the other criteria will change as well. That's what you meant, Laurie? I mean, you meant about...
Yes. That's what I was thinking, you know, just because that we're kind of going into a whole new territory in a way, and so many things in MS are changing so quickly that if you look at it and you look at the clinical studies that they have and the relapse rate, the annual relapse rate, you know, which is one of your primary endpoints, I know that a lot of the patients that are chosen for the clinical trials, you know, the later clinical trials, maybe are diagnosed earlier, whether that makes much of a difference or not. But I just wonder if down the road there won't be a different paradigm as far as deciding what is suboptimal response.
I want to jump in, too, if I might, Aliza, and just to also, you know, I think that's a great question, Lori, because it does beg the question, I put this out to the audience as well, as Aliza, is does it maybe change our expectation of what we allow for breakthrough disease? You know, with the injectable therapies, we know that we have, on average, a 30% reduction in relapse rate. When you look at fingolimod against placebo, you have a 54% reduction rate. And then at Tysabri, it's in the 60s. So does it shift our expectation as clinicians to say, you know, they're on Tysabri and they've had a relapse? Do we have less of a tolerance for relapses when we expect there to be a greater efficacy? And do we define that as breakthrough disease?
That's a really good question. That's pretty much what I was wondering.
When you look at studies, you look at group of patients. So does it mean individual? I don't know. It means individual, and that's, I think, we coming back again to the basics. What you really need, you need better marker to evaluate individual. So if Tysabri, I try to be correct and say natalizumab, but if it's 60% and interferon is 30% based on the study, it doesn't tell us really how Mr. Smith will respond. How is he going to respond individually? Our expectations are different? Maybe they are, because maybe we think Tysabri is stronger. Is it better than interferon? We don't know that. It was studied at a different time. It was not compared head-to-head, and that was my point. But it's an interesting point that you're saying, Jen. Very, very smart point. Our expectations are different, but I think more importantly, you need to have individual markers. You need, when a patient come in, and I think that's all the debate. You look at this, but you need to identify also breakthrough disease.
Right.
And if you have individual marker, you can do it based on the individual and not look in the whole trials. But again, it's not as simple as I say it. You might be right. And we'll see what the future will bring. It's interesting. What do we expect based on the treatment we choose? I use mitoxantrone in the past. I don't use it anymore, and our team is not using it as it was because of the cardiotoxicity and the leukemia cases that came up. Did I see a major changes? Was supposed to help secondary progressive MS. I didn't see major changes. My expectation probably were more, but it will be interesting to see how the future go and what do we do with that breakthrough disease and what do we do? Do we expect that natalizumab will help all patients and then we less tolerate changes or anything? I had recently a patient on natalizumab and one enhancing lesions. Was I most surprised that he has one as versus interferon? Interferon, high-dose interferon, has robust effect on MRI, on active lesions, around 90%. Tysabri, natalizumab, also have a robust effect on new active lesions. I knew that I can have one enhancing lesion on natalizumab. It's not 100%. And I know that on interferon, it's not 100%. But I don't know. It will be interesting to see.
Yeah, I'd like to open it. Thank you, Aliza, for allowing Lori and I, the chairs, to tag team you on that question. I want to allow the rest of the audience to have an opportunity to ask questions or provide comments. And, you know, we have about 14 minutes left, and so I just wanted to kind of shake the tree out there. If there's anybody else who is listening that would like to ask Aliza some questions or provide commentary. And, Doug, do we have any questions in queue?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Dottie Dolph from Philadelphia, PA. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you all for the program and also for the stimulating conversation. I guess you did allude to, but what I wanted to get back to was something I thought you said that was very powerful, is that the adherence piece of are people taking the medications properly? I just think that with new medications and some of our concerns for risks, we have an opportunity to go back to the importance of people understanding the value of utilizing first-line therapies appropriately. So along with that idea, my second thought is, how patient are you when you're suspecting breakthrough disease? But, you know, how long are you willing to give it to evaluate? Like we always say with platform therapies, it's an important decision but not urgent. So I guess if we could go back to the thought of the importance of taking the medications properly, but then also how willing are you to give it a little bit of time?
I think you always, you mean from the initiation of treatment?
Yeah, like when the person's starting to have some troubles and you're watching them, what is it that sort of takes you over the edge where you think, nope, this is breakthrough disease, I want to get in there and I want to hit it with something else?
I think you always give it time. The first 3 months or the first 6 months of a new DMA, you want to monitor. You don't want to rush into going into another medication. And I think, though, it's also, you made a point there, what's the threshold here and what is the point of it? And I think you have to look at the combination of factors. What are the changes? Is there the major changes that you can tolerate? I think any changes that affect functions, and when you treat and someone has an attack or major change and you treat with steroids and the recovery is pretty poor and not a lot of return, I think your level of concern is very high.
Sure.
And you might do it less time than you would do. Maybe you do just the 6 months. I think most clinicians look at 6 months or up to 9 months, but I think it really depends on the changes and how many areas are affected. Is it brainstem changes? Has it gait changes, motor weakness that has not recovered? So I think it's depend on the type of changes. I don't really monitor clinically all the time the EDSS, but some do, so probably maybe a point, 2 point. But I think a change on the EDSS, but I think it's really depend on the severity of the change and recovery after steroids, which would put you to either side of the threshold. But I think if small changes, I think our tolerance is pretty high, and you'll wait 3 to 9 months. If people, patients just have sensory stuff, like tingling, a little numbness that didn't affect function, I think our tolerance is a little higher.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's helpful.
Thanks so much for your comment.
Okay, I think we have time for maybe one more question from the audience. I'd like to just put that out there if there's anyone else in queue.
There's nobody at this time, Jennifer.
Okay, so Aliza, I'm going to give you the floor for the next 3 minutes if you want to talk before I close the session.
Okay, thank you, Jen. Thank you so much for all your comments and the discussion. I think it's a tough topic when you think about breakthrough disease and suboptimal response. And the time we just mentioned, that Dottie mentioned, what's the time here? And I think our tolerance is different between clinician to clinicians. Tony has mentioned some chemotherapy. So if someone has a breakthrough on chemotherapy, what do you do next? It's another. We have a lot of challenges today when we treat patients with suboptimal response. I think we are lucky, and it's exciting time because we have different treatments. We have a lot more options today than we had in the past. So it's important to look at your paradigm and think what you want to do first with this patient, that you'll have other option along the line. And hopefully we'll come with some kind of a definition. And I think we need to use this other parameter, as June mentioned, the 25-foot walk I see very helpful too. I can't measure any other objective, but then the patient walk much longer time. And definitely we want to look at cognitive issues, emotional issues, along with the disease, along the physical changes. So I think it's a good era. I think we have a lot more to go in the future, a lot more research. We are involved in many research, and I'm sure as all you are involved, so it's in we'll see a lot more new treatment, a lot more of clinical, hopefully, marker, other markers that will help us help individual patients to do better with the illness and really get them to have a high wellness and well-being and quality of life. And thank you so much for participating tonight.
Yeah, thank you, Aliza. And really, to be able to spark a discussion in 15 minutes, I think, is quite commendable. And I think we are looking forward to when the IOMSN completes the kind of bedside tool for us as clinicians. I think it will be very helpful. And also, we can try to get Dr. Friedman's a citation from you so that we could put that on the website as well for all the listeners and other members who may not have been able to join us this evening. But on behalf of the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions, I would like to thank you, Aliza, again, for your presentation, your insight, your experience, and your professional wisdom. And thank you again to Biogen IDEC for supporting these programs through, again, their unrestricted educational grant. Lori, Mayer, and I, as co-chairs, hope that you join us again next month. We will have nurse practitioner Brent Oliver, and he is going to be presenting resources for the MS nurse. And we can assure you that this will be a very unique presentation, one that you haven't heard before, and it will be quite illuminating. We're very excited to hear it. But thank you again for joining us this evening, and this concludes tonight's meeting. I hope you all have a good night.
Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's teleconference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.